Good day. Welcome to another episode of the Audible Local Ledger Reads to the Blind podcast. You can get more information at audiblelocalledger.org. Stay tuned for today's reading.
Hi, my name's Eric. I'll be reading you selections from the e-edition of today's Cape Cod Times. Today's date is Tuesday, May 30th of 2023. We'll start with the weather. Across the Cape and Islands, today plenty of sun. Nice day. A high of 62 expected. Tonight, mainly clear with a low of 49. Tomorrow, sunny and nice. All day Wednesday, 66 the high, 54 the low in the overnight. And on Thursday, expect times of clouds and sun. High of 74, low of 59. Nice day. Friday looks to be beautiful. Partly sunny. Gorgeous. High of 75, low of 55. And on Saturday, a little chillier. Partly sunny with a little bit of breeze. And cooler at 59, the expected high, and 50, the expected low. The sunrise today is at 5:10 a.m. It will set at 8:07 p.m. We'll have 14 hours and 57 minutes of daylight. Moonrise is at 3:22 p.m. and it will set at 2:40 a.m. Moving to the front of the paper, where the lottery results, and of course the news is kept, we read the lottery results because somebody asked for them. If there's something you would like read to the blind or those who are print impaired, you can email us at info@audiblelocalledger.org. You can also call us at 508-539-2030, and we'll consider reading it. And if you miss any of the information that we share in our readings, you can always go to audiblelocalledger.org. And in the upper right corner is the Archived Readings tab. If you click on that, you'll find a week's worth of our newspaper readings for your catching up. And you'll also find a wide variety of periodicals and literature for your listening enjoyment, as well as our shopping guides being located there for savings. And all of that's free for the blind and the print disabled at audiblelocalledger.org, the Archived Readings tab. Now for the lottery results, we go to masslottery.com because the Cape Cod Times goes to press too early to give you the latest results, and if you care enough to ask for them, we want to give you the latest results. So for the numbers game for yesterday, Memorial Day, Monday, May 29th of 2023, in the midday drawing, the numbers were 9702. Again, midday drawing yesterday, 9702. In the evening drawing, last night of the numbers game, the numbers were 8912. Again, evening drawing numbers game results, 8912. Powerball for Monday, May 29th, 21, 33, 35, 62, and 64, with 24, the bonus number. Mass cash for Monday, May 29th, 2, 7, 19, 21, and 30. Lucky for life for Monday, May 29th, rounds out our lottery results, 14, 17, 32, 33, and 44, with 14, the bonus number. Good luck to all who play. Remember us if you win. Now, on the cover of today's Cape Cod Times, a reminder, it's Tuesday, May 30th. Graying of homelessness. High summer rents push out a Provincetown couple by Zane Razak. In Provincetown, Pammy Nickerson, 52, and her boyfriend Juan Carlos, 61, have lived at the Eastwood at Provincetown timeshare since November. But their future is uncertain. The complex is filling up for the season and will cost $1,600 weekly starting Memorial Day weekend, said Nickerson, which is more than what they can pay. Saturday was their last day there. We have no backup plan at all. We're going to literally end up outdoors, said Nickerson on May 22nd at the timeshare. That's my biggest fear, ending up under a bridge somewhere or on the other side, on the side of the road. Nickerson and Carlos are part of a growing trend of Americans 50 and older who are struggling with homelessness. Among single homeless adults, about half are 50 and older, according to the American Society on Aging, with nearly half of them becoming homeless after 50. On Cape Cod, the graying of the homeless population poses urgent challenges, as 32% of Barnstable County is 65 or older, according to the U.S. Census Bureau. Nickerson, who has lived in town since she was 4 years old, says her nightmare began when, following her grandfather's death in 2015, she inherited his Provincetown house where she grew up. But she also became the heir to his reverse mortgage, just under $500,000, which she could not afford. She said she fought to keep the house for 4.5 years, but ultimately lost. And it's been hell ever since, said Nickerson. She was evicted in January of 2020. A moving company from New Bedford packed up her belongings and took most of her stuff there. She's paying about $400 a month between two companies to house some of her stuff. Nickerson also said she feels red tape, stifling bylaws, and failing to meet requirements has also been a barrier, as she's contacted a long list of housing agencies and organizations. She has a short rental history with few references, bad credit, and low income, she said, as well as Crohn's disease. She also doesn't want to be separated from her 4 rescue cats, a big gray cat named Blakely, Felix the gray tiger, and 2 Maine Coon sisters named Sabrina and Lily. They're staying in an animal shelter until she can reunite with them in a permanent home. They've been my support system. They've been my lifeline, said Nickerson. Nickerson and Carlos have bounced around the past couple of years, including in a metal tool shed in her cousin's backyard. The house was in rough shape, she said, with no running water, and it was later sold. They're up each morning at 5:30 a.m., and they work as much as they can, with Nickerson cleaning houses and Carlos doing yard and housework. What's left of us, we fall asleep, said Nickerson. It's depressing. She said everybody wants to talk about their trip, what they buy. Well, we can't talk about it, and we're not feeling to be social, said Carlos. We just want to keep it to ourselves. The annual point-in-time count of homeless conducted this year by the Cape and Islands Regional Network on Homelessness also showed older people making up a significant portion of the homeless. 31% of the unsheltered, which means people living in emergency shelters, transitional housing, on the street, and in cars, were between 50 and 64, and nearly 10% were over the age of 65. And local organizations are also seeing the crisis. In 2022, Homeless Prevention Council served 2,360 people, with 610, or just over a quarter of them, being seniors. The nonprofit will host a senior housing information session about future housing options at 2 p.m. on Thursday, June 22nd at Truro Council on Aging, 7 Standish Way. The event is free, and it's open to residents from all towns. Often staff will hear from a senior who's unexpectedly lost their longtime rental after a landlord decides to sell, said CEO Hadley Luddy. One Homeless Prevention Council client was forced to retire due to health issues and was living off Social Security and a small retirement. She dipped into her retirement to make rent and eventually wound up with no resources and now living on a friend's sofa while waiting for senior housing, which Luddy said could take years. So, what we've been seeing, sadly, is people calling us and saying, you know, I've been in my rental for 15 to 20 years and it's being sold. Where can I go? Said Luddy. And the sad answer is that there really is nowhere to go. Older women are among the more financially vulnerable, along with people of color, and the oldest old, quote-unquote, said Jan Mutchler, a professor of gerontology and director of the Center for Social and Demographic Research on Aging in the Gerontology Institute at University of Massachusetts in Boston. Part of that is demographics. Women live longer than men, meaning women are more likely to outlive their husbands or partners and to be living alone. Cost of living and rents have skyrocketed in Massachusetts over the past few years, she added, saying many older people rent. Rent is far and away the biggest expense, said Mutchler. Protecting and strengthening Social Security is key, she said, with many older people relying on that for a large portion of income. Making it easier to save for retirement and creating ways for older people who can work and want to work to continue working later in life will also help, she said. If a senior is facing uncertainty with their housing, Luddy encouraged reaching out as soon as possible to see how we can help them prevent any of these stressful, difficult situations by starting to put a plan in place now around their future housing needs. It's very traumatic to face homelessness as you're aging and wanting to be at an age in life where you have fewer worries than more, said Luddy, especially the folks that felt like they had a plan, stably housed, and then all of a sudden they're uprooted. Nickerson said she had, quote, no idea where we're going. I'm really frightened about what's going to happen, she said. From the Cape and Islands section, as we keep it local here, new housing planned in Orleans as HPC moves, by Zane Razak. After 23 years, Homeless Prevention Council has left its location at 14 Old Tote Road in Orleans. But that's a particularly good thing. The council's former office will soon turn into year-round housing. The new office is at 8 Main Street in Orleans. That was a really great part of the process, said CEO Hadley Luddy, knowing that the old office would be a home for somebody else to be on the Cape year-round. The nonprofit served more than 41,000 people while at the old address, Luddy said. The council had outgrown its space. Services increased by 70% since the pandemic. It was just not large enough to accommodate our growing team, said Luddy. With growing community need and expanding staff, we needed to be in a better, more centralized, and safer space. Luddy said they examined renovating the old Tote Road building, but staff learned that buying the new location was dramatically less expensive. In mid-April, the organization moved to its new location, a 2-minute drive from the original spot. The agency bought the building on Main Street for $1.15 million, according to a deed that was recorded with the Barnstable County Registry of Deeds. Luddy said the closing was in December. This was only made possible due to a core group of very generous donors and foundations, as well as our many, many volunteers and building committee members and board and staff, a whole community of folks that really got behind this project, said Luddy. With some minor upgrades in construction, the new space is meeting the organization's needs, including offering greater visibility and safer and larger workspace, she said. As an example, she said the old Tote Road building was unable to accommodate gatherings, so it was difficult to bring larger groups of clients or colleagues together or accommodate a full board meeting. In the new space, the nonprofit was able to host 2 gatherings to celebrate the REACH program, a skill development and wellness program that has ended its 5th year. Groups of former and current REACH participants, donors, staff, and board celebrated the program. We've really been able to see the ability that we now have to build community here at Main Street, said Luddy. The building previously housed Pike Insurance Agency. More recently, it was home to 2 local attorneys and Kaplansky Insurance. The nice part is that we've been able to accommodate those tenants, and they've simply moved upstairs, said Luddy. A local restaurant owner bought the old Tote Road building to create several new apartments. There's already one deed-restricted affordable rental on the first floor. Our real hope here is that more people who've heard about our work or are curious about our work to come in and see how we can help them keep living and working here on Cape Cod, said Luddy. There's a photo in the Cape and Islands section, and the caption, there is the John F. Kennedy memorial with a wreath being placed in front of it by two people. And the headline reads, John F. Kennedy Memorial Trust Fund Committee Member William Murphy, who is on the left holding a large wreath, and Barnstable Town Councilor and retired Air Force Colonel Betty Ludke, place a wreath at the memorial Monday morning. This year, Memorial Day fell on President John Kennedy's 106th birthday. A Memorial Day ceremony was held at the John F. Kennedy Memorial in Veterans Park followed by another ceremony at the JFK Hyannis Museum, where another wreath was placed. And the photo was taken by Merrily Cassidy of the Cape Cod Times. Beach reopens on Memorial Day after a pair of shootings. This is from the Associated Press, and it's in Revere, so I'm not sure why it's in the Cape and Islands section, but Massachusetts State Police temporarily closed Revere Beach because of a pair of shootings that injured three people as violence erupted over the holiday weekend. The popular beach reopened on Memorial Day, hours after bedlam erupted on Sunday evening in Revere, about 4 miles north of Boston. Two people were shot, one person was grazed by a bullet, but none of the injuries were believed to be life-threatening, state police said. A teenager questioned in one of the shootings was arrested for illegal possession of a firearm, state police said, but the investigation was ongoing to determine whether the teen was involved in the incidents. The union representing troopers said it was disgusted by the unruly behavior. Every family within the Commonwealth deserves to be able to enjoy themselves at our parks and recreational areas without fear of violence or unlawful acts, the State Police Association of Massachusetts said on Monday. The shootings happened about 15 minutes apart, but there's no indication they were related. The first happened around 7:10 p.m. Sunday as a large fight was taking place with shots fired into a group of people, injuring a 17-year-old girl, police said. A short time later, a 51-year-old woman was shot nearby, and a 17-year-old youth was grazed by a bullet, police said. And this one is local. Report of shots fired at Craigville Beach, one injured by broken glass, by Eric Williams. According to a release from the Barnstable Police Department, officers responded to a report of gunshots in the Craigville Beach parking lot Saturday evening. One person received minor lacerations from broken glass during the incident, which appears to be targeted, not random, according to police. Craigville Beach, which is located on Nantucket Sound in Centerville, is one of the town's most popular beaches. The large parking lot has 450 spaces, according to the National Institutes of Health. In an email to the Cape Cod Times, Barnstable Police Lieutenant Mark Mellon wrote that the department's patrol division will be making additional security checks at the town's beaches. Those with information about the incident are asked to contact David Kyle Phelan at 508-778-3874 or 293@barnstablepolice.com. Again, 508-778-3874. And that's all the local news of the front half of the paper. Heading back to the front page to more national and regional. Low inventory and high demand keeping used car prices up. Jamie L. LaRoe in Detroit. If you're looking to buy a used car or truck, there's good news and bad news. The good news is that prices for used vehicles have come down from the all-time highs of last year. The bad news is that supplies remain just tight enough and demand just high enough that prices remain at historic highs, and they're not likely to come down anytime soon, according to the first quarter 2023 used vehicle report from car shopping site Edmunds.com. Consumers returning to the used market for the first time in years might find conditions a bit shocking, said Ivan Drury, Edmunds Director of Insights. Not long ago, $20,000 was seen as an acceptable amount to spend on a used car to get an optimal blend of miles and age. In today's market, $20,000 puts consumers into a much older or much higher mileage vehicle. Are used car prices dropping? Asks the bold subheading. The average transaction price for a used vehicle in the first quarter slid by 6.4% to $28,381, compared with $30,329 a year earlier, Edmunds data showed. But that's up 44% from the first quarter 5 years ago, when a consumer could buy a used car on average for $19,657. Edmunds' report showed that the share of used vehicles in the quarter to sell for less than $20,000 was about 31%, compared with 5 years ago when it was nearly 61%. The reason for the high prices? The supply of used vehicles is being squeezed, as the number of leases on new cars dropped to 559,000 vehicles in the quarter, compared with 1 million leased vehicles in the first quarter of 2018. That means fewer drivers returned vehicles when leases expired to feed the used car stockpile. Also, Edmunds data showed trade-in volume declined to 5.5 million vehicles last year from 6.2 million vehicles in 2018. Car rental companies are also a factor in the low supply of used cars for sale, as those companies struggle to get new cars during the parts shortages of recent years, the number of vehicles it would feed to the used car market dwindled. Now those vehicles coming off rental are much older and pricier than they had been in the past, prior to the parts shortage. As of March, the average off-rental vehicle age had climbed to 3 years, up from 1.9 years in the same period 3 years ago. The average price climbed to $28,916 in March from $15,829 in the same period 3 years ago. Got a used vehicle? Get money. But on the new vehicle side of the industry, the share of cars that sold for under $20,000 was less than 1% in the first 3 months. The transaction price for a new car in the first quarter of 2023 averaged $47,774, compared with the first quarter of 2018 when it averaged $35,784, Edmunds data showed. But back to that good news again. If you're a car owner who's held on to a car longer than you otherwise might have because of the high new car prices and inventory constraints, you will be rewarded for it. Your trade-in is probably worth more now, even if it has more mileage on it than it would have been had you traded it in sooner, Drury said. For example, in the first quarter, the average mileage of a 2018 Toyota Camry was 60,565 miles, Edmunds cited in its study. That's a 130% increase compared with this time 3 years ago, when a 2018 Camry trade-in had an average of 26,288 miles on it. But instead of a price decline, the used car market's slim inventory has pushed the average transaction price of that vehicle up by 8% to $21,223 in the first quarter of this year, compared with $19,656 in the first quarter of 2020, Edmunds data showed. Those shopping for used cars will need to be extra diligent, and research is critical, said Joseph Yoon, who's Edmunds Consumer Insights analyst. Some shopping tips from Yoon include, know your trade-in value. Extra equity from your trade-in is one of your biggest negotiating tools. Before you begin shopping for a vehicle, get a free appraisal from various websites, including Edmunds, so you can factor your trade-in value into your budget. Shop for pre-approved financing. Interest rates for used vehicles are hovering near record levels, so seek approval from more than one lender. Then, with a pre-approved loan offer in hand, you can decide if the finance rate that the dealership offers is the better deal. Flexibility and thoroughness. If you're used to buying 1 to 2 year old used cars, consider shifting to slightly older cars and buy from a reputable dealer that offers a detailed vehicle report. Finally, know what you're buying. Consider paying a mechanic to do an inspection on the car before buying it, and always test drive the vehicle. Last month, analysts at Edmunds said that the average annual percentage rate on new vehicles in the first 3 months climbed to 7%, compared with 4.4% in the year-ago period. It's the highest level Edmunds has recorded since the first quarter of 2008. It means the average monthly payment for new vehicles was $730 in the quarter, compared with $656 a year earlier. With that in mind, Edmunds analysts said they expect used vehicle prices to stay high through the rest of this year unless new vehicle sales take a turn. If new car sales stall out, automakers and dealers could leverage heavier incentives to entice consumers into new purchases, which would in turn place downward pressure on used car values, said Drury. But since most automakers have been deliberate in aligning vehicle production and demand to avoid the inventory glut issues they faced prior to the pandemic, consumers probably shouldn't count on any major bargains or discounts through the rest of this year. On the national front, President and the Speaker seek debt deal votes by John Fritzi and Joey Garrison of USA Today in Washington. Now that President Joe Biden and House Speaker Kevin McCarthy have reached a deal to avoid a first-ever default on the nation's debt, they're turning to an arduous task, selling it to their allies. Both leaders projected confidence over the weekend about an agreement struck late Saturday to raise the debt ceiling until 2025 in exchange for spending caps and other GOP demands. Biden, McCarthy, and other leaders have less than a week to pull together the votes to shepherd the measure through a splintered Congress. It will be an intricate dance, with both sides eager to tout wins they extracted without inadvertently tanking support for the agreement, details of which were just made public on Sunday. The first test will come Tuesday, as a critical House committee takes its first vote. The sales job started over the weekend, including with a call Sunday between White House negotiators and House Democrats. If we had a Democratic White House, a Democratic Senate, I think the budget would look different, White House spokesman Ben LaBolt said Monday on MSNBC in response to initial criticism from some progressive lawmakers. Asked on CNN if the White House was concerned about the Rules Committee vote, LaBolt said that we'll leave to the Speaker to win support from Republicans in Congress to move this forward. Even as lawmakers spent the Memorial Day recess in their districts, there were echoes of discontent that reached Washington. Hardline conservatives said the bill will not produce the scale of spending cuts they wanted, while liberal Democrats said they were uncomfortable with concessions Biden made on safety net programs. So what's next for the debt deal? Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen on Friday projected the government would be unable to make debt payments by June 5th, and to avoid default, Congress must pass the agreement by then. The House Rules Committee will take up the debt ceiling legislation Tuesday, and they'll hash out a rule to bring the measure to the floor. The debate could provide an early sign of whether Republicans who control the House will hold together today to support the package that McCarthy and Biden negotiated. Complicating that effort, to win the speakership this year, McCarthy named several conservatives to the powerful committee. And assuming that the legislation clears the committee and then the House, it would then move to a divided Senate, where any one member could throw sand in the gears. Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer, Democrat from New York, warned his colleagues to prepare for a vote Friday or potentially into the weekend. And what's in the agreement? The tentative deal raises the debt limit through the end of 2024, meaning Washington won't have to address the issue again until after the next presidential election. And among the provisions are spending. The deal caps annual discretionary spending for 2 years. This means that funding for domestic programs across the board, besides Social Security and Medicare, will stay the same next year, level funding. Safety nets. The agreement overhauls the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, known as SNAP, by setting time limits for how long able-bodied adults 54 or younger without dependent children can receive food assistance if they don't meet certain work requirements. The IRS. The deal partly rolls back a funding increase for the Internal Revenue Service that was designed to crack down on wealthy Americans and corporations that evade taxes. And student loans. The deal ends the pause on student loan payments that's been in place throughout the pandemic. We're at the midway portion of our reading of the Cape Cod Times, dated Tuesday, May 30th of 2023. We'll move to a different kind of local news, the obituaries and the death notices. There are two in today's Cape Cod Times. The first is of Bruce Walter Tripp of Falmouth, a retired marine chemist who passed on May 9th at the age of 80. He was born and raised in Acushnet on a farm which provided training for his future vegetable garden. He graduated from Acushnet High School, attended New Bedford Institute of Technology, which is now UMass Dartmouth, and earned his bachelor's degree at URI, the University of Rhode Island. He was married to his loving wife, Helen Lane Tripp, on July 4, 1964, after which the couple joined the U.S. Peace Corps and served in Campuchia, Brazil, from 1966 to 1968, where they taught children and parents to grow vegetables and raise rabbits for food. Upon returning home, he and Elaine settled in Falmouth, where they raised their son, Aaron, often joining Aaron and Troop 38's scouts and parents on many hikes, camping, and canoe trips. In 1969, Bruce joined the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution, known as HUI, where he worked for 47 years and worked for the Chemistry Department and the Coastal Research Center. One of his first projects was working with HUI Associated Director Bostwick H. Ketchum on the Coastal Zone Management Workshop, leading to the influential book, The Water's Edge. Bruce participated in several research cruises in the western North Atlantic and numerous coastal research cruises. He authored and co-authored many reports, scientific papers focused on marine environmental quality issues. He also made many good friends while at HUI, including visiting scientists from China, France, Japan, and Switzerland, who then hosted him and his wife in their countries over many years. He was a pioneer in Falmouth's open space preservation efforts. In 1985, he spearheaded the town's purchase of the Sea Farms property in Davisville and then became a co-founder of the 300 Committee Land Trust. Bruce was a persistent negotiator, and he and Elaine tirelessly undertook any task to secure a town meeting and voter approval of his proposed open space acquisitions. His major contribution to open space preservation was recently acknowledged in the dedication of Elizabeth Saito's book, Walking Falmouth, A Guide to Falmouth's Best Nature Hike. Bruce and his wife enjoyed visiting and sharing meals with friends and working in their large vegetable garden and preserving its bounty, which they shared at Christmas with friends and family. In 2007, he was predeceased by his wife of 43 years. He leaves many who will miss him dearly. A private memorial service will be scheduled at a later date. In commemoration of his life, the family's making contributions in honor of Bruce Tripp to the 300 Committee Land Trust and the Woods Hole Public Library, where Bruce's wife was librarian. Others wishing to honor Bruce are encouraged to make donations to these organizations with a note of, quote, in honor of Bruce W. Tripp. The other obituary in today's Cape Cod Times of May 30th is of Dorothy Lombardi of South Yarmouth, who passed at the age of 90 on May 24th. Born in Springfield, March 30th of 1933, she lived in Ludlow for most of her life until she moved to the Cape in 1998. She worked as an executive assistant and sales representative for Monsanto until she retired. Dorothy had been a member and CCD Teacher of Christ the King Church while she lived in Ludlow. She was a member of the Hyannis Yacht Club, and she loved her social life on the Cape. The wife of the late Aldo Lombardi, who died in 2000, Dorothy is survived by many who will miss her dearly. Funeral services will be held Wednesday, May 31st, that's tomorrow, with calling hours from 9 a.m. to 10:30 a.m. at NOAC Funeral and Cremation Services at 15 Ludlow Avenue in Springfield. It will be followed by a funeral mass at 11 a.m. at Christ the King Church in Ludlow and burial in Island Pond Cemetery. And that concludes the obituaries and death notices that are listed in today's Cape Cod Times, dated May 30th of 2023. Heading back to the front page, the headline, the international headline in this case, Russian strikes rattle Kyiv in daylight, by Hanna Aryova of the Associated Press in Kyiv, Ukraine. Explosions rattled Kyiv during daylight Monday as Russian ballistic missiles took aim at the Ukrainian capital, hours after a more common nighttime barrage of the city by drones and cruise missiles. Russian forces fired 11 ballistic and cruise missiles at Kyiv at about 11:30 a.m., according to Ukraine's chief of staff, Valery Zaluzhny. All of them were shot down, he said, and puffs of white smoke could be seen in the blue sky over the city from street level. Debris from the intercepted missiles fell in Kyiv's central and northern districts during the morning, landing in the middle of traffic on a city road, and also starting a fire on a building's roof, the Kyiv military administration said. At least one civilian was reported hurt. The blasts unnerved some locals, already under strain after being awakened by the night attack. After what happened last night, I react sharply to every siren now. I was terrified, and I'm still trembling, shared Alina Senfontova, a 50-year-old woman who took refuge in the Kyiv subway with her dog Bublik. The central station, Tetatralnya, was crowded with sheltering locals. Artem Zila, a 24-year-old who provides legal services abroad, took his laptop with him and kept working underground. I heard two or three explosions, went to the bathroom, and I heard five or seven more explosions, and that's when I realized something terrible was happening, he said. Like many others in the capital, he feels exhausted and stressed. However, he has no intentions of giving up and plans to attend his yoga class to recharge. This is certainly not enough to break us, he said. Ukraine President Volodymyr Zelensky and First Lady Olena Zelenska both posted a video of what they said were frightened schoolchildren running and screaming down a Kyiv street toward a bomb shelter as sirens wail. This is what an ordinary weekday looks like, the president wrote on Telegram. Russia uses Iskander short-range missiles in the morning attack, the spokesman for Ukraine's Air Force said on local television. The missiles were fired from north of Kyiv. Yuri Ikhnat said that without clarifying if he meant Russian territory. Kyiv lies around 236 miles from the Russian border. The Russian Defense Ministry said that early Monday it launched a series of strikes targeting Ukrainian air bases with precision long-range air-launched missiles. The strikes destroyed command posts, radar equipment, aircraft, and ammunition stockpiles, it claimed. It didn't say anything about hitting cities or other civilian areas. Ukrainian Foreign Minister Dmitry Kuleba warned against indifference, saying the repeated strikes on civilian areas amounted to war crimes. Russia's drone and missile attacks on peaceful Ukrainian cities cannot be seen as usual, no matter how frequent they grow, he tweeted in English. During the previous night, Ukraine air defenses brought down more than 40 targets as Russian forces bombarded Kyiv with a combination of drones and cruise missiles in their 15th nighttime attack on the capital so far this month, said Serhii Popko, the head of Kyiv's military administration. On Saturday night, Kyiv was subjected to the largest drone attack since the start of Russia's war. At least one person was killed, local officials said. The Kremlin's strategy of long-range bombardment has brought many sleepless nights for Ukrainians. Over the winter, Russian forces aimed their missiles and drones at power plants and other infrastructure. The apparent goal was to weaken Ukraine's resolve and compel the Ukrainian government to negotiate peace on Moscow's terms. But Ukrainians swiftly and defiantly repaired the damage. In recent months, Ukraine has been receiving advanced air defense systems from its Western allies, improving its ability to fend off bombardments by the Kremlin's forces. Across the country, the Ukrainian Air Force said that over Sunday night it shot down 37 out of 40 cruise missiles and 29 out of 35 drones that were launched by the Kremlin's forces. Four civilians were killed and around two dozen others were injured, including three children and a pregnant woman, in Russian shelling elsewhere across the country, authorities said. Russian warplanes dropped bombs on the town of Turetsk on Monday afternoon, killing three civilians, Donetsk regional governor Pavlo Kirilenko said. Strikes on the eastern Propetrovsk region killed two people, officials said. Meanwhile, in the Belgorod region of Russia on the border with Ukraine, one person was killed by Ukrainian shelling of the village of Grafovka, according to Governor Vyacheslav Gladkov. Russian missiles also slammed into a military airport in the western Khmelnytsky region of Ukraine, destroying 5 aircraft, damaging the runway, local Governor Serhiy Hamali said on television. The strike sparked fires at nearby warehouses that were storing fuel and military equipment, he added. Some challenging names and places in there that I have not seen before. Russian, particularly challenging because of the use of multiple vowels and consonants in a row. Moving inside the paper, we've completed the front page and the local news. In the Nation and World section, plastic pollution treaty talks resume. Second meeting on global strategy begins in Paris by Thomas Adamson and Jennifer McDermott of the Associated Press in Paris. A United Nations committee met in Paris Monday to work on what is intended to be a landmark treaty to bring an end to global plastic pollution, but there's little agreement yet on what the outcome might be. The Intergovernmental Negotiating Committee for Plastics is charged with developing the first international legally binding treaty on plastic pollution, including in the marine environment. This is the second of 5 meetings due to take place to complete the negotiations by the end of 2024. At the first meeting, held 6 months ago in Uruguay, some countries pressed for global mandates, some for national solutions, others for both. Because it's an extremely short timeline for treaty negotiations, experts say that in this second session, it's critical that decisions are made about the objectives and scope of the text, such as what kind of plastics it will focus on. But that's easier said than done. More than 2,000 participants, including governments and observers, from nearly 200 countries, have descended on the meeting hosted at the Paris-based UN cultural agency, UNESCO. One fundamental issue being considered Monday was the system of voting on decisions for each nation, which has already produced lively debate and delays in the plenary sessions that are due to end on Friday. Humanity produces more than 430 million tons of plastic annually, 2/3 of which are short-lived products that soon become waste, filling the ocean and often working their way into the human food chain, the United Nations Environmental Program said in April. Plastic waste produced globally is set to almost triple by 2060, with about half ending up in landfills and less than a fifth of it recycled, according to the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development. The treaty could focus on human health and the environment, as desired by the self-named High Ambition Coalition of Countries, led by Norway and Rwanda, with limits on plastic production and restrictions on some of the chemicals that are used in plastics. The coalition is committed to an international, legally binding instrument to end plastic pollution by 2040. It says this is necessary to protect human health and the environment while helping to restore biodiversity and curb climate change. Alternatively, the treaty could have a more limited scope to address plastic waste and scale up recycling, as some of the plastic-producing nations and oil and gas exporters want. Most plastic is made from fossil fuels. Countries supporting this plan include the United States, Saudi Arabia, and China. The U.S. delegation in Uruguay said national plans would allow governments to prioritize the most important sources and types of plastic pollution. Many plastics and chemical companies want this approach too, with a plastic waste treaty that prioritizes recycling. The International Council of Chemical Associations, the World Plastics Council, the American Chemistry Council, and other companies that make, use, and recycle plastics say they want an agreement that eliminates plastic pollution while retaining the societal benefits of plastics. They're calling themselves the Global Partners for Plastics Circularity. They say that modern plastic materials are used around the world to create essential and often life-saving products, many of which are critical to a lower carbon, more sustainable future. Joshua Baca, vice president of plastics at the American Chemistry Council, said countries are so different, a one-size-fits-all approach won't be effective, equitable, or implementable. Instead, the agreement should require national action plans, as that will most effectively eliminate plastic pollution specific to a country's specific situation. The International Pollutants Elimination Network, or IPEN, wants a treaty that restricts chemicals used to make plastic that are harmful to human health and the environment. To focus on plastic waste in this treaty would be a failure, because you have to look at plastic production to solve the crisis, including the extraction of fossil fuels and the toxic chemical additives, said Dr. Tedesse Amira, the network's co-chair. IPEN's international coordinator, Bjorn Bieler, said countries need to make a plan by the end of this week to write up an initial draft of the treaty text so it can be negotiated at the third meeting. If there's no text to negotiate, you're just continuing to share ideas. And then because of the timeline, we could be looking at an early failure. Thousands evacuated as a typhoon nears the Philippines, by Jim Gomez of the Associated Press in Manila. Philippine officials began evacuating thousands of villagers. They shut down schools and offices and imposed a no-sail ban Monday as Typhoon Mawar approached the country's northern provinces a week after battering the U.S. territory of Guam. The typhoon is packing maximum sustained winds of 96 miles an hour and gusts of up to 118, but it is forecast to spare the northern mountainous region a direct hit. Current projections show the typhoon veering northeast by midweek toward Taiwan or southern Japan. Authorities warned of dangerous tidal surges, flash floods, and landslides as it blows past Cagayan and northernmost province of Batanes from Tuesday to Wednesday. Gusty winds lashed eastern villages of Cagayan on Monday, causing an old and unoccupied warehouse in a wharf to collapse and prompting more villagers to move to evacuation centers. Nearly 5,000 people have sought shelter in Cagayan, Batanes, and other provinces, said Assistant Secretary Rafael Alejandro of the Office of Civil Defense. He said the number was expected to rise, given the precautionary evacuations that were underway in flood and landslide-prone regions. Classes and office work, except for those involved in disaster preparedness, have been suspended. Flights to and from the provinces have been canceled, and fishing and passenger vessels have been prohibited from sailing. Even if the sun is up, the weather is so unpredictable nowadays and could change any time, so we should always stay on the side of safety, Alejandro told the Associated Press. We're talking here of potential threats to lives. Mawar tore through Guam last week as the strongest typhoon to hit the U.S. Pacific territory in over two decades, flipping cars, tearing off roofs, and knocking down power. These typhoons, earthquakes, and natural calamities have been a part of our lives, Batanes Vice Governor Ignacio Villa told the AP by telephone. We cannot afford not to prepare, because that would potentially mean the loss of lives and major damage. Army troops, police, firefighters and volunteer groups were standing by for search and rescue operations, and more than a million food packs have been prepared for any contingency, officials said. Villa said that the local government lent ropes to villagers in high-risk communities to strengthen their houses as the typhoon approached. Batanes, a chain of islands with about 19,000 people, has been experiencing nightly power outages in recent days because a tanker ship carrying fuel for its power generators had taken shelter from the approaching typhoon. While the typhoon was threatening mostly the country's northern provinces, government forecasters said it could enhance monsoon rains in other regions further south, including the capital, Manila, and in the central Philippines. About 20 typhoons and storms each year batter the Philippine archipelago, which also lies on seismic faults where volcanic eruptions and earthquakes occur, making the Southeast Asian nation one of the world's most disaster-prone. New anti-gay legislation in Uganda carries death penalty in some cases, by Rodney Muhumuza of the Associated Press in Kampala, Uganda. Uganda's president has signed into law tough new anti-gay legislation supported by many in the East African country, but widely condemned by rights activists and others abroad. The version of the bill signed by President Yoweri Museveni didn't criminalize those who identify as LGBTQ, a key concern for campaigners who condemned an earlier draft of the legislation as an egregious attack on human rights. But the new law still prescribes the death penalty for aggravated homosexuality, which is defined as cases of sexual relations involving people infected with HIV, as well as with minors and other categories of vulnerable people. A suspect convicted of, quote, attempted aggravated homosexuality can be imprisoned for up to 14 years, according to the legislation. Parliamentary Speaker Anita Among said in a statement that the president had answered the cries of our people, quote unquote, in signing the bill. With a lot of humility, I thank my colleagues, the members of Parliament, for withstanding all the pressure from bullies and doomsday conspiracy theorists in the interest of our country, the statement said. Museveni had returned the bill to the National Assembly in April, asking for changes that would differentiate between identifying as LGBTQ and actually engaging in homosexual acts. That angered some lawmakers, including some who feared the president would proceed to veto the bill amid international pressure. Lawmakers passed an amended version of the bill earlier in May. LGBTQ rights campaigners say the new legislation is unnecessary in a country where homosexuality has long been illegal under a colonial-era law criminalizing sexual activity against the order of nature, quote-unquote. The punishment for that offense is life imprisonment. The U.S. has warned of economic consequences over legislation described by Amnesty International as draconian and overly broad. The UN Human Rights Office said Monday it was appalled that the draconian and discriminatory anti-gay bill is now law, describing the legislation as a recipe for systematic violations of the rights of LGBTQ people and others. In a joint statement Monday, the leaders of the UN AIDS program, the U.S. President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief, and the Global Fund said they were deeply concerned about the harmful impact of the legislation on public health and the HIV response. Uganda's progress on its HIV response is now in grave jeopardy, the statement said. The Anti-Homosexuality Act of 2023 will obstruct health education and the outreach that can help end AIDS as a public health threat. That statement noted that stigma and discrimination associated with the passage of the act has already led to reduced access to prevention as well as treatment services for LGBTQ people. Erdogan faces inflation and Ukraine, secures 5 more years leading a key NATO nation, by Susan Fraser and Zeynep Bilginsoy of the Associated Press in Ankara, Turkey. Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan has a mandate to rule until 2028, securing 5 more years as leader of a country at the crossroads of Europe and Asia that plays a key role in NATO. He must now confront skyrocketing inflation that's fueled a cost-of-living crisis and rebuild in the aftermath of a devastating earthquake that killed more than 50,000 people. Erdogan secured more than 52% of the vote in Sunday's presidential runoff, 2 weeks after he fell short of scoring an outright victory in the first round. His opponent, Kemal Kılıçdaroğlu, had sought to reverse Erdogan's increasingly authoritarian leanings, promising to return to democratic norms, adopt more conventional economic policies, and improve ties with the West. But in the end, voters chose the man they see as a strong, proven leader. Erdogan thanked the nation for entrusting him with the presidency again in two speeches that he delivered in Istanbul and Ankara. "The only winner today is Turkey," Erdogan said outside the presidential palace in Ankara, promising to work hard for Turkey's second century, which he called the Turkish century. The country marks its centennial this year. Kılıçdaroğlu said the election was the most unjust ever, with all state resources mobilized for Erdogan. Supporters of Erdogan, a divisive populist and masterful orator, took to the streets to celebrate, waving Turkish or ruling party flags, honking car horns, and then chanting his name. Leaders across the world sent their congratulations, highlighting Turkey's and Erdogan's enlarged role in global politics. His next term is certain to include more delicate maneuvering with fellow NATO members over the future of the alliance and the war in Ukraine. Western politicians said they're ready to continue working with Erdogan despite years of sometimes tense relations. Most imminently, Turkey holds the cards for Sweden's hopes to join NATO. The bid aims to strengthening the military alliance against Russia. Turkey's also central to the continuity of a deal to allow Ukrainian grain shipments and avert a global food crisis. In his victory remarks, Erdogan said rebuilding the quake-struck cities would be his priority. He also said 1 million Syrian refugees would go back to Turkish-controlled safe zones in Syria as part of a resettlement project being run with Qatar. Erdogan has retained the backing of conservative voters who remained devoted to him for lifting Islam's profile in Turkey, which was founded on secular principles and raising the country's influence in international politics. Erdogan's rival was a soft-mannered former civil servant who has led the pro-secular Republican People's Party, or CHP, since 2010. The opposition took months to unite behind Kılıçdaroğlu. He and his party haven't won any elections in which Erdogan ran. In a frantic outreach effort to nationalist voters in the runoff, Kılıçdaroğlu had voted to send back refugees and ruled out peace negotiations with Kurdish militants if he was elected. Erdogan and pro-government media portrayed Kılıçdaroğlu, who received the backing of the country's pro-Kurdish party, as colluding with terrorists and supporting what they described as deviant LGBTQ rights. Erdogan transformed the presidency from a largely ceremonial role to a powerful office through a narrowly won 2017 referendum that scrapped Turkey's parliamentary system of governance. He was the first directly elected president in 2014, and he won the 2018 election that ushered in the executive presidency. In regional news, Vermont governor vetoes largest budget in state history in Montpelier, Vermont. Vermont's governor has vetoed a state budget that would have been the largest in the state history. Republican Governor Phil Scott said the proposed budget, which is well over $8 billion, would unfairly raise taxes and fees on state residents. He said in his Saturday veto message that Vermonters have made it clear living in our state is not affordable, and lawmakers shouldn't ask them to take on more burden. Scott called on lawmakers to work with him on a new spending plan. The Vermont legislature is controlled by Democrats and adjourned its session by passing the budget. Vermont Senator President pro tempore Philip Baruth said the legislature can't act again until late June. Baruth called the veto disappointing and said senators will need to recalibrate our approach as we work with our partners in the House on a response to the governor's action. China aims at crewed moon landing, also plans to expand the country's space station in Beijing. China's burgeoning space program plans to place astronauts on the moon before 2030 and expand the country's orbiting space station, officials said Monday. Monday's announcement comes against the background of a rivalry with the U.S. for reaching new milestones in outer space, reflecting their competition for influence on global events. That conjured up memories of the space race between the U.S. and Soviet Union in the 60s and 70s, although American spending, supply chains, and capabilities are believed to give it a significant edge over China, at least for the present. The U.S. aims to put astronauts back on the lunar surface by the end of 2025 as part of a renewed commitment to crewed missions aided by private sector players such as SpaceX and Blue Origin. The deputy director of China's space agency confirmed the twin objectives at a news conference, but gave no specific dates. And with that, we've come to the end of our reading of today's Cape Cod Times, dated Tuesday, May 30th of 2023. This is your reader, Eric, saying be well, be safe, look after each other. Remember our veterans every day, not just Memorial Day. Thanks for listening. Bye for now.